Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Welcome back to the Rugby League Digest. I'm Michael Adams, and this is a really super special episode, joined by Steve Mascord, who will be no stranger to anybody who's listened to our series. I'd say Steve might be mentioned more than any other journalist in my compilation of well over a million words of research notes. Now, I'd say a conservative estimate, Steve, you probably account for about 100,000 of those. So you were definitely in the trenches on the front line during the war, and perhaps for that reason you've written the new book Two Tribes, which again I don't think this is going to be news to any of our listeners, but I'm really happy to have the chance to talk through it all with you. So thanks so much for joining me, Steve.
No worries, Michael. It's interesting you say that, because I don't think my name appears once in Mike Coleman's book, or it might appear just once. And I don't feel like, I felt like I was on the periphery of that period rather than being in the trenches at the time. So maybe if that's the case, maybe I just kind of, at the time when I was doing my job every day, I had more of an eye on the future and context than other people. And maybe that's why my name's popped up in your research more than other people, because I certainly don't think I was someone who was out there necessarily breaking the biggest yarns every day. You know, news had a bit of an, you know, they had a bit of an in, obviously, and then there were other journalists like Alex Mitchell at Fairfax who were getting fed stuff as well. And so I was more just trying not to lose each day rather than trying to be the superstar covering the Super League war. But yeah, it's interesting you say that, and obviously, you know, it goes without saying that I'm a, you know, big fan of your show and series, and you pretty much have a direct line to everybody who's interested in this subject matter. So this is important.
Yeah, well, hopefully we can connect any of your fans that don't know us and any of our fans that don't know you. But I dare say there's not many of those on either front. So, yeah, as I said, really looking forward to getting into it. I want to start with talking about you've done something really interesting with, like, I guess, promoting the book and planning for the book over the last 18 months ago with the Substack. You're releasing these daily posts, and it was really cool. Last year, at various stages, we were kind of running in lockstep. So we'd release one of our episodes at the same time that you were talking about the same thing. And that was kind of really cool. Anytime our paths did cross, I got a big kick out of that. But can you, like, give a little insight to how you devised the Substack and how you went about getting this book off the ground?
Well, the first book I did, Touchstones, I just did a crowdfunding thing, and actually it started on New Year's Day here in Ireland. You know, I just woke up on New Year's Day, whatever it was, 2015 or 16, and said, I'm going to do it. Oh, it's time I did this book and Touchstones. And so I launched a crowdfunding, and it's just basically the learning out of that. You know, I learned that people want substance. You know, if they're going to, let me put it this way, if you're going to support something, you know, and you just want to give money to your friend, that's one thing, but you're not going to get as many people as if you although maybe you do, I don't know. But anyway, I thought that I wanted to give people some value, and also I was still writing the book at the time, so it actually allowed me to kind of dispense with that kind of writer's impatience, where you do like an instant hit of feedback whenever you do something, and books are very lonely. So I thought it was a good opportunity to kind of already to get some feedback from people while I was still writing the book. So it's been good. I think the whole project is a slow burn. I think there's still people signing up for the Substack, you know, 14 months later, and it finishes on December 19 this year. And equally with the book, I'd like to think your average person who watches Friday Night Football and doesn't think about rugby league most of the week has no idea the book exists, and that's exactly as I want it to be, because I'd like to think that by the end of this year and the 25th anniversary of the NRL Foundation, that I will be able to sort of break into the mainstream a little bit with it, and I want it to be a slow burn. So, yeah, Substack's been great. It's a lot of work. It's but for me, not having, living in London, not having a workplace to go to, it gives me some routine. It's the first thing I do each day. And if I miss a day, then I have to do, I have to catch up. I have to do two. I still haven't done December 31, 1996. So it's been a really positive experience.
Anyone who's not signed up, incredible value for money. For the price of just a book, you get all these extra posts. And it's really extraordinary how much you get for what you'd pay for just the book anyway. So it's a really cool thing that you've done.
Yeah, well, like I was lucky enough to get some leftover Touchstones books, for not much money. So that allowed me to sort of value add a little bit. It's still a lot of these things I'm doing with Two Tribes. I had no idea how the ledger would look, financially with a lot of these things. And I sort of, it was kind of suck it and see a little bit. And, it is good value. It's still not, I'm not running at a loss, but it was just guesswork when I set it up, because I'd never worked with Ingram Spark before. I didn't really know how much it would cost to print a book, because I didn't know how many pages it'd be. Even if I did know the cost per page, I didn't know how many pages the book would run to. So when I started it, I just kind of picked an arbitrary figure, which is $45 US for everything. And I think initially I actually said postage not included. And then in the end, it just became too complicated. So postage is included. But certainly the books that people get via Substack, I don't make much money on.
Is that kind of a reflection of the state of the industry now, both in terms of journalism and in terms of publishing?
I don't know. I think I learned from Ingram Spark via Rob Bergen, who's the listeners might be aware of, involved in Latin Heat. And as Robert Rakow was at Rugby League Week for many years, worked for Queensland Rugby League. He's done everything. He's a bit of a hero, actually. And he told me that you can, do this, put the self-published on Ingram Spark, and you have complete control. It isn't prohibitive even to print one book at a time. And I had another friend called Dennis Gray, who does the Australian Rock Show. He's based in Canberra. He's a big old Raiders fan, and he always wanted to write some children's fiction. And he wrote some children's fiction and sent me one of the books from England. He got it printed in England, just one book, and had it sent to me and said it was very inexpensive. So I went, rather than waiting around for someone to get interested from the mainstream publisher, I'll just do this. And Nigel Wood was the one who pushed me to do something like this to start with. And he gave me an advance, and I have to repay that advance. And he has a stake in the book after that as well. So I think it's a good model. I don't think it's desperate. I just think that a lot of it was guesswork. Until I got a report from Amazon, just like yesterday, Amazon in Australia, I had no idea the impact of, how the discount you've got to give retailers, or it's recommended you give retailers, against the cost of printing the books and how much that leaves you with. So I didn't know until I got my first statement from Ingram Spark, and I'm gonna decrease the discount that I give retailers because I'm left with very little. But it's all suck it and see, and it's exciting. And this morning I woke up and saw that it was number one on all books about ball sports on Amazon Australia, which is a chart it hasn't topped before. It's obviously number one in rugby league. It's number four in UK rugby league on Amazon, but it's actually number one because the three books ahead of it aren't rugby league books. They're rugby union books or sports group books. So I've been very happy with how it's gone so far.
Congrats on getting it out after what must have been a really long process and a lot of work, you can tell, has gone into it. I want to ask, what was the spark for deciding this would be your second book? And when did you start thinking along those lines?
It's funny. I was listening to Dennis Gray did an interview with a guy who wrote a book about AC/DC. He said, what made you want to write a book about Malcolm Young? And he said, Well, it's my living. I write books. Someone asked me to. And, and in this case for me, it was Nigel Wood coming up to me at the very first ever Toronto Wolfpack game in Brighouse and saying, having a bit of banter because he always kind of feels like hard done by and poorly, and he feels like the media is always down on him and fans down on him. And so I have a little bit of that sort of self-loathing banter. And then he said, you should do a follow-up to Mike Coleman's book. Nigel has a program in his collection from the 1907 Orgulfs. So even though there's a public perception, I think, of Nigel as being an accountant who kind of got, took rugby league or made a lot out of rugby league. You know what I mean? Did a good job of being rewarded for his efforts when he left. He actually is a super enthusiast for the game, and he's a massive collector, and he donated thousands of programs to archive up in Bradford, whichever one it is. And he's held on to the programs. He doesn't trust them to curate properly. He showed me a HH Messenger program from 1907. So he is like a real historian, and he wanted the book to bring Coleman's book completely up to date, which as a reader and as someone who I guess is an official in the game, it's a kind of, you can understand why you would think that and why you would want that. But Coleman's book only covered 14 months, and I soon discovered that I wanted to write a book that only covered the next 14 months. And so there was a bit of pushback from Nigel about that and about the original concept. But in the end, I think he's happy with it. And I think those little chart positions, be that as it may, it's kind of like topping a music chart these days. It's not like it was in the 80s, but it's still good to, I think he's happy with that so far. He's happy with
it. It's funny you mentioned the Coleman book, which was obviously very formative for our first season. And then you have Roy's book, which covers a bit more into 1996, but then basically nothing. And for us, that was like one of the real starting points for us, is like, this was such a monumental moment in rugby league, and there's just been so little coverage of it, and it just gets buried in mainstream rugby league shows and journalism. And for Andy and I, it was just really confusing that there hadn't been more done about it. And I wonder if you have any thoughts on why that is, or any insight to...
Sure. Everything rugby league does, and everything the mainstream rugby league media does in Australia particularly, is motivated by money and ratings. And the Super League year rates poorly. People don't like it. They don't like talking about it. I spoke to Neil Whittaker, he said it was his first rugby league interview in 20 years. I don't know if that's true, but he said that you're the first person to ask me about the Super League war. People want to forget about it. They don't want to know about it. No one asked me about it ever. They asked me about South being kicked out, and he was kind of, he was ready for questions about South. And when I didn't ask South questions, he brought it up himself, I also, the name escapes me, but Roy Masters put me in contact with a documentary maker who did a thing called The Super League War, and you can see the trailer for it on Vimeo, and he gave me some outtakes, which I quoted from in the book. And he couldn't get funding for it. He couldn't get any money for it. He paid Roy out of his own pocket to do voiceovers, and just it went no further. And that's because rugby league is a product. And basically, this is an airline trying to sell tickets, and it doesn't want to remind people of the year it had plenty of crashes. You know what I mean? It's a can of baked beans in the supermarket. That doesn't want to remind people of the year it was tainted and they had to be sent back to the factory. Rugby league is a commercial endeavor, and this is an uncomfortable truth. And the people who show rugby league on TV don't want to make their audience feel bad. You watch even the hardest hitting current affairs show, they won't show extreme suffering, because it makes the audience feel bad. It makes the audience turn off. So I've got a very clear idea as to why we don't read or hear about these three seasons, but particularly 97.
It's sad, and I don't know. Maybe to me, it seems it's also the small market thing as well. If you look at America, for instance, all of their major sports are national; they cover the whole country, and there's enough of an audience that you can get these 30 for 30s and all these other historical programs, but I don't know. To me, it seems there should be a market for good historical content from Australian rugby league.
Look, rugby league is not all of New South Wales and Queensland demographically and class wise. And I always tell people the story about, you know, which team finished last and won the premiership in the same year in Australian sport, and it was one of the VFL teams. Might have been Footscray, where basically all the Irish Catholic suburbs of Melbourne kept playing Australian rules in the First World War, and all the Anglo suburbs stopped. So the team that finished last also made the semis and won the competition. And that neatly sums up what AFL is in Melbourne and what rugby league is in Sydney. Rugby league is not all of Sydney, and rugby league sells mixed drinks and hardware to Western Sydney, and that's what it is. It's a billboard pointed at Western Sydney, and the people who run those media outlets who are selling things to those people, they don't think they're interested in that sort of thing, you know. And I guess there's a cultural that there's a slow cultural change, and you know, your podcast is clearly part of it because it's enormously popular, and maybe this book can be part of it. And but I always was more interested in those things that the rights holders didn't think the audience was interested in. So I think sort of sociologically, you can come up with a kind of hypothesis as to why it's been underreported.
I want to turn to the events themselves, and I know your book covers 1997, but I'm really interested in your experiences being there, you know, from the start of the war onwards. So when did you first hear about Super League?
Well, I was actually on a Shark podcast yesterday, and I know it sounds sort of pretentious. I know if I interview a musician, and he said, as I was saying to someone before I spoke to you, but they asked me about, you know, we were talking about my friendship with Shane Richardson and stuff like that. And we also talked about people making decisions back then, which they have to reflect on for the rest of their lives. And I, because I was very close to Shane Richardson, I knew he and John Lang were coming to Sydney, months before it was ever announced. And I just never thought that it didn't occur to me that I would break that confidence. It never occurred to me. I also knew there was something going on with news, and we, you know, there was obviously, originally it was public knowledge that, you know, that Kerry Packer had threatened to sue the pants off everybody, and Ken Cowley had said it will go through the front door, you know, if we come back, as your listeners are all too aware. After that, I knew by Shane, my friendship with Shane, that there was something going on and that news was still sniffing around. So I guess I kind of, but I never wrote it. And, you know, and it might be to my eternal damnation as a reporter, but I just, no one else told me. It wasn't like it was around and I could just say I got it from multiple sources. I only knew it from that one source. And I knew that I couldn't breach that confidence, just the same as I hadn't breached it when Shane and Langy came to Sydney. So I guess I knew about it when everyone else knew about it. I knew about it when everyone else knew about it. I kind of knew that there was stuff going on with Cronulla when they were in Perth. You know, they're signing up, and I just followed the train all the way through. I just followed it every day, I guess, right up to. But the thing is, I was always away in the off season, so after Super League 1 in October, I took time off. I went to New Zealand and followed Great Britain around and stayed in backpacker joints. And, you know, when the NRL was formed, I was God knows where, Sunset Strip. So I don't know. I wasn't anywhere near the Sydney Cricket Ground. I was on holidays. But aside from that, I guess I followed every day. But I was always, because my training was at AAP, I was more about quotes. I was more about pinning people down and getting them to say something on the record. And I was always about getting a quote in the third paragraph. So I wasn't so much, to me, because of my training at AAP, maybe lack of courage as well, just didn't want people bagging me. I wasn't one to write an entire unsourced story about what I'd heard. You know what I mean? And plus I was young. So I'm not sure the Sydney Morning Herald would want to hold up the whole back page on what some bloke they just got off AAP thought was going to happen. You know what I mean? So, but my recollections, I guess when we talk about that and whether my decisions were good or bad at the time, and you're better off asking the people I worked with, they'd be better more impartial.
Yeah. It's interesting to hear someone say that the first they heard of Super League was April Fool's and it being legitimate. So that's really interesting.
Well, yeah, it isn't that, but that's not 100% true, you know, because I did know that that news was still sniffing around, and so that's not 100% true. But if I could have stood it up, I would have written it. But I only knew about it from one source, and it was kind of shady, and there was obviously that whole thing where news were leaking stuff to Fairfax because they wanted to get the big end of town, and we're not on video, we're on audio, but I'm doing the quotation marks in the air with my fingers. The big end of town, and you know, Alex Mitchell, I think, was over in this part of the world. He was in the UK, and he was getting tip-offs about what was happening with Super League because they wanted it to be a kind of a non-partisan phenomenon. You know, they didn't want it to just be a news limited and kind of thing.
When something like this happens, so, you know, April Fool happens and everything explodes, as a journalist, are you more concerned about, you know, what's happening to the game that you love and the game that, you know, pays your way? Or are you just thinking, wow, this is really good news. This is a big story. You know, I've got to get, you know, some quotes and all that sort of thing.
Well, I never thought the game paid my way because I think you can only do journalism if you believe that you can go and cover something else tomorrow. Because if you think the game is paying your way, you don't work for the reader. You know, you're biased. You might as well be a crooked referee. So I was always excited about it as a story. I thought it was a fantastic story. And I love the fact that people that I already had a relationship were on different sides, and they suddenly had positions of seniority. Someone like Trevor McEwen or Rebecca Wilson, or, you know, these sort of people were suddenly administrators, you know. And I always got on well with, you know, Graham Annesley. I didn't know David Gallup, Bill Harrigan, you know. I thought it was a fantastic story. And as a rugby league fan, and I think you should take what is good out of your fandom for your round, you know. And I always say you don't need to be a mass murderer to be a police roundsman. And the same thing applies to rugby league. But my fandom meant that I was really excited that there were two of everything, you know. There was two New South Wales teams, two Australian teams, four extra games a week, two teams in Newcastle. So to me, I always loved the ritual of going off to cover games. The further away, the better. And that was a kind of little illusion or routine or fantasy that maintained my enthusiasm in my job. So even though I was serious about sort of impartiality and all that sort of stuff, I was always happy to draw on the colourful things that kept me keen to work hard, and all of the things in Super League, almost all of the things in Super League, to me were more colourful, more interesting, more glamorous, and therefore they made me keener to work hard. But it also meant that I was keen on covering things that no one else wanted to cover. My favourite game from the year was Hunter Mariners versus Paris Saint Germain, because to me that was really glamorous and fun. And to people who were just kind of dyed-in-the-wool traditional rugby league fans, or those journalists who just were cynical, more cynical people than me, to them it was the worst part of the year, and to me it was the best part of the year. I was enthusiastic about it, you know, and even in writing the book, I'm enthusiastic about the story. Someone put up a story today about they took a picture of a page about the Aussie players being in the dressing room at the cricket in '97 at Headingley, and Luke DeVico being asked to repeatedly hit Jason Croker across the forehead with a cricket bat that had just been used in a test match, and Shane Warne holding Jason Croker's false tooth while everyone watched this happen. It's hilarious. It's such a great story. And I always, I was positive about the year, 1997. Nothing about it depressed me. I mean, I could see what depressed me was the way people were behaving and the way it depressed other people. But to me, the year was fantastic. There was more of everything. There was more travel. It was more everything. It was fantastic. I was enthusiastic about the year, and I smile when I think about 1997 from a personal point of view. And the more I get asked about it, I think about more stories. I remembered Paul Tagliabue going to Shark Park for a game.
Yeah.
The commissioner of the NFL. I remember that yesterday just because someone asked me to talk about it. The other day I remembered I froze on air at a Penrith game. It was one of the first times I ever worked for Ray Hadley, and I was horrified. I was distraught for weeks afterwards. That happened in 1997. So I was hyper aware every day in 97 because I was into everything, super, super into everything. And I personally, to this day, miss the Adelaide Rams and I miss Paris Saint-Germain. So that was my favourite. It's my favourite. I've got to say, 1997, I never said this in the book and I haven't said this to anyone else. 1997 is my favourite season. I loved everything about it. I just didn't like the way everyone else hated it and everyone else was depressed. You know what I mean?
I think anyone who's read Touchstones and knows about your crazy schedules and being in three states or four countries on the same day to watch, you know, five different games, that kind of makes sense that you'd appreciate that side of things.
Yeah, I loved it. I loved it. The game was on so many different channels. And like in 1995, I got friends in Perth to record Reds games and people on the Gold Coast, two of my friends, to record Titans games and send them to me and post them to me like people in England. Like, so for me to have to have the Warriors versus St. Helens on the ABC, you know, with Debbie Spillane topping and tailing it, it was paradise. We never saw those games. Before the Super League War, we saw two or three games a week. We always saw the same teams. And I was, as I said to someone, I went to the 1982 Grand. I went to watch the Steelers in their first year play Canterbury at Belmore, and I'm lining up for a hot dog beforehand, and someone goes, "What jersey is that you're wearing?" And I said, "It's Illawarra, that's who you're playing today." People didn't even know the strip of teams in the Premiership. I went to the Grand Final. When Eddie Lumsden came to play for St George from Newcastle, he didn't know St George's strip. Seriously. He came from Newcastle to St George in the 60s and said he didn't even know what jersey they wore. So so to me, in 1997, it was so exciting to be able to watch, you know, Bradford and Paris and, you know, and the Hunter Mariners and all these teams on TV that never got any airplay before, you know. And so 1997 was my favourite season.
That's probably a good place to talk up the much-derided World Club Challenge. And we're going to be covering it in detail. And there are things to deride. I'm not going to sugarcoat it. But one thing that I've found really striking in my research for 1997 is going through each issue of the Super League magazine. And there is, and this is really a comment more than a question, but I'm keen to get your thoughts. But it's astounding how much English coverage there was, like far more than any other point in Australian rugby league media. And to me, at least, that is part of the way to justifying the World Club Challenge and saying, well, you know, it was lopsided and maybe it kind of made Super League look a bit foolish, but it was probably worth it.
Yeah, it wasn't worth it. I mean, the thing is, the broader question is that John Rebo will still argue to this day, and Maurice Lindsay says Super League won the war because we had all the other countries on side. We just saw at the World Cup, you could not win a single argument, even a pub argument in Australian rugby league, by saying you've got other overseas countries on board today. So the international game was far more important then, and Quayle and Arfison and Bozo and these guys, they gave it far more credence then than the Australian game gives it today. And it's not beyond the realms of possibility that at some point in the future, the NRL might divorce itself from the International Federation and they might put together their own Tonga and whatever teams. But I think they do so completely unfeelingly and unthinkingly. They do it purely from a commercial point of view, and 85% of their fan base wouldn't notice. So, you know, the English game, what Super League, and equally, I guess more importantly, if Rupert Murdoch was trying to start a new streaming platform in Australia up against the NRL after losing the TV rights, he wouldn't go and sign up other rugby league playing countries. So the you're right, that was a peak of the credibility being given to the English game. And I know for a fact that the News Limited reporters, you know, like Peter Frelingos, were not huge fans of the English game, and that it was really the vision It was really Rebo and a small group of people who had News's ear, who pushed that agenda forward. And they were made to look like fools by the results in the World Club Challenge. I asked, who was it? Ian Robson, you know, who was marketing manager at the time, because there's so many funny stories about the World Club Challenge, hilarious stories. And I asked Ian Robson, who was marketing manager at the time, hey, got any funny stories for me? I've got this one and that one. He goes, I can't remember anything funny about the World Club Challenge. It was a nightmare trying to sell it to people and convince people that it had any credibility. Ian Schubert said, well, it certainly was a challenge, you know. I don't think. I think it actually was. It was the peak. You're right. It was the peak of credibility being given to the British game in Australia. But what caused the slide from the peak was the actual matches. I don't think it justified it. I think it undermined it. You know, it was the matches themselves undermined the concept. And as we know, the fixture wasn't played again until 2000. And as we also know, is not considered very high, not even considered important enough for Penrith or the NRL to respond to emails in 2022.
Yeah. And I guess this is why it was botched in execution, but it was... They were onto something in terms of making it kind of a mid-year thing where both seasons were happening at the same time and it was an actual competitive thing rather than a glorified trial.
Yeah, you say a competitive thing. I mean, the Canberra players came to London and just drank all the way, you know, leading up to their game. I mean, Kevin Walters told me that, you could smell the Halifax guys in the scrum. It was like you wanted to get the ball out as quickly as possible. They stunk so much of alcohol. You know, half a dozen players were arrested. People were sent home. You know, and so at the time, probably the game wasn't professional enough. The players had just freshly moved from part-time to full-time. And they just treated it like a mid-season holiday, both sides. I think we've also been up that hill in sport with the peak of Super Rugby, where we were all told to take these fixtures against teams with no place name, you know, seriously. And what happened due to COVID is we've become more parochial again. We've retreated to our enclaves, and that kind of vision, to use the word for the first time in this interview, that vision is on a downswing now, generally, in the way people consume sport. We're back to being our own backyards, parochial, blah, blah, blah. And the World Club Challenge is a predictable barometer of how outward-looking our sport is. If we're in a period of optimism and adventure, we tend to play it. And if it's not played, it tends to be an indication that we've become, inward-looking again.
Back to the rest of Super League. You mentioned you loved it. It's your favourite year. You loved all the travel. Did you think much at the time, or have you had a chance to reflect on the actual execution of Super League and whether there was a different way to win more hearts and minds?
Yeah, I guess I have, but I think a lot of people who were involved in Super League, the Trevor McEwans and Ian Robsons, now say, and, you know, people who worked at Canberra, Bevan Hannon, say that it lacked authenticity, and that authenticity is granted by the audience. It's not created by the clubs or the league or the players and then that in turn speaks to what rugby league is and what it isn't. You know, so. So what we did is we learned what rugby league isn't, and it's not a glitzy, easily transferable product that can be franchised and be successful purely as an entertainment form. Now, you can say there were examples of that, Like Adelaide drew good crowds, Perth drew good crowds, London Broncos went quite well, Paris kicked off in front of 16,000 people, Sheffield won at Wembley. But the core won't support the outposts. The core is completely blue collar and desperate for money, desperately poor and blue collar. And so I don't think Super League, I think Super League could have been executed. Wayne Bennett basically said in the book, there's a whole chapter devoted to Wayne Bennett. I left him off the back cover in the first edition. Whoops. But Wayne Bennett said, we lost it when we didn't get Newcastle. That's what he said. So basically, and that's the story of Two Tribes. That's the story of 1997, the importance of Newcastle and how one community and one group of players unwittingly became the torchbearers for the entire spirit of a sport and for 100 years of history and of many communities who'd lost interest, and how happenstance allowed them to get to the finish line. You know, that those torchbearers didn't look like they were even going to get in the stadium, let alone run around once around the oval, once around the track and cross the finish line. But due to a whole heap of really intriguing once-in-a-lifetime circumstances, they actually found themselves crossing the finish line first. And as a result, the game bounced back much more quickly than it otherwise would have. So in answer to your question, I would say that Super League could have executed things better if they'd just basically gone after the same people the ARL did, you know, just suburban people in Sydney and not even bothered with Perth or Adelaide. But see, that was all that was left for them, right? They had to go for those things because the new clubs on board had no loyalty to Phillip Street and they were easier to pick off than the Parramattas and the Manlys and the Roosters and blah, blah, blah. So they had to go for what their opposition didn't have. And that's rugby league's place in the rugby marketplace. Rugby league's place in the sports marketplace is to go for the working class people, the people who live week to week, because the other rugby's got everyone else. And, you know, you might say Super League failed to capture the wider imagination because it had to take the part of the market that was left by its major competitor. And you could say equally that rugby league over 126 years has failed to get the imagination of the wider marketplace because it has to live off the people that are left. So the more we talk about it, the more we can hypothesize as to the reasons things have happened over the last 126 years for rugby league, 127 now. And more importantly, the more reasons we can come up with for why things haven't happened for rugby league.
Well, that leads to the other side of that equation, which is the fallacy of tribalism, which I hated any mention of that in our, you know, coverage of the war, because yes, there's an element of truth to it, but what Andy and I always come back to is where were the tribes? You know, it was these, you know, supposedly diehard fans from various pockets of Sydney, and 5,000 of them were turning up to games. So I don't know how you square it with Super League being too glitzy and being seen as artificial, but there being like a genuine need for something to change with how rugby league was being presented. So what was the answer?
Yeah, but those 5,000 people, along with 40,000 in Brisbane, are all the game had, and they didn't want to share it. And to an extent, they're still all the game has. They're still worth selling mixed drinks and hardware to. And that's why Fox and Channel 9 keep the lights on at League Central every day. And that's why League Central is willing to bend over for those organisations and shut down their own digital unit to keep the lights coming on. And the other people, the new people, they're too transient. So the people, you know, Paris's crowds went from 16,000 to 4,000 in the course of a year. If the Murray Hurst era at Melbourne Storm had it continued, or the Mark Murray era at Melbourne Storm had it continued, then they might also be a footnote in history now. So unfortunately, rugby league sometimes, maybe once a generation, tries to take off the sort of down pit training wheels, and the bike ends up careering into the hedgerow every single time. And now we live in the hedgerow. You know, that's where we live. And so a visionary will come along and try to put us, take the training wheels off again with the help of a billionaire every generation or so. And maybe one will get it right. Maybe some we won't need the training wheels eventually. But at the moment, that's where we live. We live where we just crashed off the road 25 years ago.
And you hear a lot of talk along those lines, which I can understand. The online NRL Twitter in particular is a very negative place, and no decision by an administrator or no article from, you know, the Telly or Fox can come out without being met with, you know, a barrage of criticism, and much of that is justified. But I'm kind of like, well, don't we need to embrace the fact that this is what the game is for all its faults? And we can criticize the faults, but this is kind of what it's always been.
Yeah, but I'm enthusiastic. I'm going to Bridgend on the way home to watch a first round Challenge Cup game between two amateur teams. It'll be cold and wet, and it'll be my first game of the year. And, you know, but you can like what you have and still want it to be better. If I hear a record that I really like, my favourite album of the last 2 years, I can guarantee you haven't heard, and none of the listeners have. And it's okay to tweet about it every day and want people to know it's good, you know. But equally, I haven't worked in the music industry for 25 years, so I haven't seen the mistakes bands have made trying to reach a wider audience over and over again. So I can be naive like that and go, you know, and I am like, I do send people emails and say, oh, I'd like to help, you know, I'd like to help the Angels get some shows in England. I don't know the first thing about booking shows. So that's great, you know, but if I had worked in that industry for 25 years and I had seen people try to do that and I'd seen the mistakes they'd made, it'd be wrong of me and stupid of me and brain dead of me not to point out that was tried 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 15 years ago, 20 years ago, and it didn't work. And here's why I think it didn't work. And if that's being negative, it's being negative, but it's also speaking the truth as I know it to be. I am sitting here saying on a rugby league show that rugby league is, you know, basically commercially there to sell things to working class people, and people only get involved commercially or in a partnership as a broadcaster because they want to reach working class people. They are not trying to reach the listeners to this show when Fox give Peter Volandis several million dollars. We are not the target. It's not, we're guests in their midst. We are kind of just annoyances. The machine of rugby league is not built for us. So, and I feel completely comfortable pointing that out at every opportunity.
Is this something a sentiment that you've developed over time, or say in 1997, were you aware that this is the game we're in?
No, I wasn't aware. No, and I developed this attitude more writing this book. You know, just crystallised in my mind. I had to write a chapter called "Quote Peace" unquote with my impressions. And as I wrote it, I thought more. And as I'm answering these questions, I think more about things that I've spent my life thinking about. And what Super League was it gave the dreamers, the visionaries, the people maybe like you, maybe like many of the listeners, a fairy godfather. Someone came along and said, and it's like if anyone in your business, if you've pitched an idea to someone, you pitch your because you want them to invest in your idea. Maybe you don't go as far as that Holmes girl who's just been sent to jail, but you pitch your idea of reality to someone because you, and they give you money Okay, they give you money if they believe in your idea of reality. And they might do diligence, due diligence, or they might not, or they may not do much. Well, Rupert Murdoch wanted to get his pay TV into people's homes, right? So he, and John Rebo ran the most successful club in the Sydney Premiership and was unhappy and was disillusioned. So I think Rupert Murdoch was pretty predisposed to listening to and believing anything John Rebo told him. And even though News Limited had some success in that they got rugby league on TV, listening to the dreamers and the visionaries didn't work for Rupert Murdoch, right? It didn't work. So people go, well, that's rugby league. That doesn't work in rugby league. Same as if I try to put on an international, well, if I'm Jason Moore, okay, let's say I want to put on a rugby league international in America on an Origin weekend. I look to what happened to that weekend, what happened to Jason Moore, and I don't get involved in rugby league. So what it shows is that rugby league is not a sport for entrepreneurs, okay? And what Super League showed is that rugby league is not a sport for internationalists or people who target a higher demographic or people who want to reach someone other than the sort of average suburban person in Sydney and Brisbane. That is what Super League taught the marketplace, that it's not for those people. It's a sport if you want to reach the people it's always been attached to. It's not a sport if you want to reach others.
It's interesting thinking about Rebo in particular and how much, this is my assessment, you've interviewed him, you'd be able to speak on this more than me, but my assessment is he 1,000% believed in the vision. For him, it wasn't just pay TV subscriptions. He thought this was the way. Do you agree with that assessment of
100%? And John, I spoke to John 3 times for this book. Long, most time I spent on the phone to anybody. He still speaks about Mandarin commentators and, people wearing uniforms and smiling when they show people to their seats and all those things. He wanted rugby league to be better. He probably, even though some of you and some of your listeners may dislike John Rebo, he actually probably has more in common with you than you would care to admit. So John Rebo's, and John Rebo ended up going to Melbourne and he negotiated the realities that the Super League war taught us, and he still achieved something great. The only true expansion club in rugby league history that succeeded. And Auckland's not an expansion club because it's already played rugby league there. I mean, and every other team, South Wales, London's in the second division, Paris, Adelaide, Perth, every other true expansion team in full-time professional rugby league since 1895 has failed. John Rebo, the guy who got Rupert's attention through his vision for the sport, ended up with that enduring success, and it will always be it'll always be on his record and part of his legacy. So that's a long answer to your question, mate. But the answer is yes.
Yeah, no, and yeah, we definitely very much admire Rebo's passion. I think he made a number of mistakes along the way, but I think he was very genuine in his motivations. But when I think of Rebo and that division again, and think about it in terms of what you were saying about the commercial motivations for it, I think about the fact that the ARL were kind of halfway there. They were bringing in the new clubs, but it was just so Sydney-centric. They just couldn't make the clean break they needed to. It was all about rationalization was always 3 years down the track. And I wonder if you had Rebo, you had the ARL going in a new direction, whether it could have worked if it was like an internally motivated concept rather than having this pay TV.
It was internally motivated because Quayle and Arfison's concept, and I, and maybe they never said this publicly, but I was there on the hill on the first day of the 95 season overlooking Perth. And their concept was that no team would be propped up, right? Teams wouldn't be propped up. So I was thinking about this yesterday. If it had been survival of the fittest, we would have lost as many. We would have been down to 14 teams by the turn of the century anyway. Souths, Wests, Balmain, Illawarra would have they wouldn't have made it to the turn of the century. St George already talking to the Roosters about merging. Perth were already broke that morning. They hadn't played a game.
Yeah, already broke that morning.
The Crushers, their management of their finances was shown to be not great. They were asking players to take pay cuts, even with the Optus money coming in. Now, I appreciate the Optus money was going to players, not to the clubs, but you would suggest the Crushers were maybe would have ended up a failed experiment just on financial grounds. So by the turn of the century, you would have been down to your 14 clubs anyway, you would say. And unfortunately, you still would have ended up with too many teams in Sydney, but the same too many teams as we have today. So I think you're 100% right there that if Rupert had have decided to jump to rugby union, or if, and you know, we can't forget that this bit of war, you know, Rupert Murdoch and Kerry Packer met on a boat in the Bay of Islands. They met in London, and they were able to make the whole thing go away very quickly. Then a key element of this story is old school honourable men being honourable. So Quayle and Arfison and a lot of the club, they were like, we've got a contract with Kerry Packer for pay TV. He doesn't have any pay TV station, but we've got a contract and our word is our honour and blah, blah, blah. Whereas the modern approach to these sort of things in business is that contracts just add a zero to the end of a settlement or seven zeros to the end of a settlement. And if that attitude had been applied by more people, then you would imagine that because let's remember, Kerry Packer didn't have pay TV outlet and he obviously bequeathed or gave the rights to Optus. Then we would have had that, probably had that, that attrition that was planned anyway. And it would have been perhaps a stage managed attrition with the business nous of news and the kind of model of the Broncos coming to the fore. But we had honourable men who were determined to be honourable. And so they protected a contract which actually meant less to their partner than it meant to them. And so that's how we had the Super League war.
That's been a reoccurring theme of our series, that rugby league is driven by and held back by rugby league men in equal measure. Like the game doesn't exist without them, but it can't advance without them. And so maybe that goes to what you were saying earlier about how we're in the position we are.
Yeah, and what's more, they scare away non-rugby league men all the time by being rugby league men. So, you know, every time an outsider comes in and wants to sort of commercialize things, they get frozen out. You know, they get, you know what I mean? Like, so, I mean, I can't blame, you know, there's so many, you know, decisions made at the time by everyone who was working in the game every day that you could go back and say, what if I'd done it differently? What if I broke my, you know, trust with Shane Richardson and wrote a speculative piece at Super League's Back On? What if, you know, I had a, you know, 96 at the preliminary final when Cronulla played Manly. I was telling the story yesterday. Jacqueline Magne was off with Manly because she'd written some stories that Bozo didn't like. And the players in the dressing room were singing after David Peachey dropped the ball three times. Millions of, you know, the President of the United States of America. Millions of peaches for me. And I wouldn't dream of writing that. I went back to the office and told people in the office and she put it in the paper the next day, you know. So you've got this kind of, in this small microcosm of these competing narratives where I was like, I should be able to trust other people in the office to say things without it being in the paper. And her going, the readers deserve to know this. It's a part of rugby league history. And they were singing in front of journalists and that's their risk. You should have written it. You know what I mean? And so, and the Steelers saying, well, you know, we were loaned $1 million to more than that, whatever it was, to build the Steelers club. How could we desert the ARL when they gave us an interest-free loan to build our club? We can't do that. It's not honourable. And yet, you know, but you've got people like Peter Moore and Roger Cowan, I guess, who were like, look, I'm here to protect the club and make sure it survives into the future and everything else is secondary. You know what I mean? And I'll make whatever decisions are necessary so that this club survives, you know, into the future. Peter Gow, you know. And so these are essential moral dilemmas that we all face in life. And they are the stories of this period. We had a we had a landscape that was the same for 100 years, and then we had tectonic plates moved very quickly over 3 years, and now we are left with a completely different landscape because of those tremors that only over 3 years, and that landscape has proven to be just as unchanging in the 25 years since.
I want to ask how different that landscape is, because from a viewer perspective or a fan perspective, it took a long time to get all the fans back, and some haven't come back. But for those who stayed, it was kind of like this, you know, tumultuous period, and then it's like, okay, round one, 1998, we're all back together, cool. Rugby league's back, and you know, didn't think about it any more than that. And now we're left with still many Sydney teams, arguably too many Sydney teams. And how much has actually changed?
Well, I think one thing that's changed is in 1995, we didn't understand the importance of IP, okay? So we were like going, our thought was like, too many teams in London, let's move Arsenal to Rotherham. You know what I mean? That was because that was our, we looked at the American model and we saw it as inevitable. And I was one of those people. I was like, Americanization of the Australian rugby league and of all Australian professional sports is inevitable. And that's why we had Sydney Bulldogs, Sydney Tigers, Sydney City Roosters. And what the Super League War did is it put a kind of, I've been big on metaphors this morning. I think I've been good with them. It put the wind of change blowing at the door. It put a doorstop under the door. So when the doorstop was in the door, the direction of the wind changed. So now we understand that Balmain can be in a small catchment area and it can be basket weavers and baristas, but because of nostalgia and social media and marketing and merchandising and community memory, that Balmain could conceivably be a successful business without having any more people go through the gate. And because we now have more than the entire wages bill of every club paid for in TV rights. So what's changed is very much that we now understand IP. We understand the value of your dad and your granddad and his granddad having followed the same club and you following the same club. And so the Americanization, the inevitability of Americanization of Australian rugby league is gone. It's completely gone. It is possible that we can have 8.5 teams in Sydney for the foreseeable future, and various other factors can compensate for their weaknesses. So that is the biggest change, I think, our biggest change now that we don't necessarily think, you know, the sport doesn't think it needs a national footprint anymore. It looks at itself purely through dollars and cents. If it can pay its bills, if the television money's on the table, then we don't need to move teams around like they're on a chessboard.
One thing I'm struggling with for our series is working towards a clear resolution of the story. So everyone always talks about Super League War making for a great scripted drama, but one of the challenges of that, in my opinion, is the narrative arc. So there's no satisfying climax. There's no protagonist or antagonist that's there from start to finish. The heart of the drama is 1995, and then the Super League season isn't for 2 years after that. And the resolution is messy with not a lot fundamentally changing. So what do you think about that? And how did you approach that challenge for the book?
It's very easy, right? And I, in the first line of the book, the first couple of lines, I say that if it was listen to the wanker quoting himself, but you know, say that if this was a movie, it would need symbolism, and the symbolism would be a faceless functionary of BHP getting up and saying we're closing the steelworks at the loss of 4,500 jobs, and a rock going through the window of the Hunter Mariner's office at Birmingham Gardens in Newcastle. That would be the opening scene, and then you put Paul Harrigan at the centre of the story, and I guess the story finishes with you know, Paul Harrigan running out for the round one, 1998, and then you have a hero, and you have good and bad, and you have one hero who can focus good and bad around him, and then you can sort of submerge the nuances a little bit in the story. You can hint at the nuances, but you don't need to really go into them too deeply. So that's the way you tell a story and make it a mass market story in very quickly.
Yeah, and you've got the fairy tale ending with Newcastle, which you touched on before, and it's very glib. It's a cliche at this point to say that Newcastle saved the ARL in 1995, and in winning the comp the way they did in 1997, they gave the ARL credibility and made... I don't know if it broke a different way. Maybe the Super League season was just so hated anyway that whatever the ARL did would have been viewed as the official season of 1997. But Newcastle winning the way they did kind of saved the ARL a second time, at least in terms of public perception and the legacy of that year.
Yeah, 100%. So Newcastle, the ARL, when Ian Frickberg and Neil Whittaker sat down at a restaurant, which is identified in the book, and we're going to go back there on December 18 this year, but you've got to read the book to find out where it is. When they toasted the deal that would be done the next day with a port, one of them had a lot of money in his back pocket and the other one had nothing. I mean, Optus Vision were touted at the start of 1997 as having committed until the turn of the century $120 million. That actually only committed for that year, and it was 30. You know, so it was only Newcastle's victory that gave Neil Whittaker a cracker to bring to dinner that night. You know, I think, Ian Frickberg had a Grange Hermitage and Neil Whittaker had a bottle of Night Train, 99 cents, you know, wine for that night at dinner. And so Newcastle allowed the ARL to credibly claim they brought the public with them to the table. And subsequently, we saw that News were willing to subvert their own involvement in the ARL, in the Super League in 1997. The place you will least likely to hear about Super League is on Fox, you know? Though it was part of what got rugby league on Fox, because it goes back to the nature of rugby league. Rugby league relies completely and absolutely on the communities that begot it in order to survive from one day to the next. And what Newcastle did is they brought the last community that cared to the table and gave the ARL some ammunition. But that meant we lost Adelaide, you know, we lost Gold Coast, it still didn't save St George, Illawarra, Norths, West, Balmain, Manly from merging either. While we still have Canterbury, Penrith, and Cronulla, so even that didn't it didn't quite make it even when the cards fell in 1998.
Yeah, and I always say you could say that News Limited, you know, ARL won in terms of public perception, but News Limited won on almost any other front. But I always say if you're asking who won the Super League War, you're asking the wrong question.
No. Well, yeah, I think it's a good question, but it depends on what theater of war you're looking at. It's like if you look at a world war, and I guess you could say the Russians were on one side and then they're on the other side, and what did they get out of the war? And like if you're talking about business, Kerry Packer told Jeff Cousins to give up. He said, "You can't beat Murdoch. Give up." Jeff Cousins just kept getting money off his shareholders to pay ARL players so the ARL could put up a fight, because he needed the content on Optus Vision. And so Packer won the business war, and Roy Masters goes into this in chapter and verse. He hardly paid for any players and ended up with a bit of Foxtel. And what he did is he propped up Australis. So News were getting all their paying through the nose for their movies from Australis. But Australis was a microwave operation for pay TV, and so no one was watching Australis. Australis was going broke. So all the Super League wars going on, all this stuff's going on, Australia, and so Rupert was just waiting for Australis to go broke. Packer's sitting back. He's not paying any rugby league players. He's showing Super League on Channel 9. And what does he do? He props up Australis, make sure they survive so that news are snookered. And that's what, according to Matthew Kidman, the business journalist, that's what ended the Super League war. So Packer won the business war, right? If it's a TV war, if it, as people say, it's all about pay TV, the great cliche, right? Well, news set out to get rugby league on TV, and they got it, right? So from TV point of view, you know, they got rugby league. They paid too much for it, but they got rugby league. It's on Fox now. There's no Optus Vision, okay? But from a spiritual rugby league point of view, the ARL were in the Alamo surrounded for 3 years, and yet people came out of the war believing they'd won, despite all those things, you know? So they won by kind of retreating into their enclave and marshalling the people who were the core rugby league fans, the people who believed it was a working class property and should always stay that and believed it belonged to the people. They exploited that, and they won the spiritual battle to the point where the actual winners have been going around denying they won ever since. You know what I mean? Like Souths actually, News won on appeal the right to kick Souths out, but News had to let Souths back in because cab drivers wouldn't go to Fox Studios. So there's three different answers, and probably if you ask another aspect of the war, then I'll come up with a different answer. There cannot possibly be one answer to that if you think about the subject for more than 5 minutes.
I want to finish this interview the way we finished our second season, which was a column of yours, October 1996, just after the appeal verdict. So I'm just going to read this. This is one of your quotes. "We are once again close to a pretty good outcome for rugby league. A national competition, the Sydney mergers everyone always thought were necessary, the sort of international media exposure others would kill for, and the backing of a media empire. Admittedly, the death or denigration of traditional sports administration is sad and regrettable, but the law says it's legal. Heavens above, if things developed a certain way over the next couple of months, we might even be able to sit back and look at the torment of the past 2 years as a necessary evil." Is there a way to argue that at least some of that ultimately came true? Can we take any good from this period?
100%. And I put some quotes from David Gallup because I'm doing the Substack, and I found, and I'm looking for things to put in there some days, and I found some quotes from David Gallup, which absolutely should have been in the first print run of the book and are in the second print run of the book. And he said that, you know, that a lot of the good things that have happened to rugby league since would not have happened without the Super League war, such as, you know, the proper enforcement of the salary cap, you know, fair and, well, some people say it isn't, but proportional policing of off-field, you know, misbehaviour, you know, the fact that the TV rights, even though they were artificially kept down, he didn't say this, obviously, but they were artificially kept down with the partnership with News, they did actually hit something like they did actually hit something like their market value to the extent where, you know, the NRL officials were shunned at a party for Rupert Murdoch. You know what I mean? They actually, so, you know, he said, you know, he argues that so many things commercially, as far as the NRL realizing its commercial potential and being able to do things like buy touch football and unfortunately launch a digital arm which made money until it was shut down. A lot of those things wouldn't have, you know, David Gallup argues, and I have no reason to disagree with him, you know, wouldn't have happened without the Super League war. So I think the legacy, the legacy of the Super League war are mainly in the robustness of the NRL as a business. And a lot of those things are the things that upset us, you know, the taking down of videos off YouTube and, you know, all that sort of stuff that annoys us, not responding to emails from little people, all those things. But they are the things, whether you like them or not, that we got from the NRL became this big, robust business. And then COVID came along and made it shrink again. you know, and left it at the beck and call of the broadcasters once more. And I guess now we really sit in that regard where we sat at the end of Mike Coleman's book, with, you know, we don't know where that's going to go, whether the NRL is going to, retreat more within itself and become just, a whipping boy of Nine and Fox, or whether it's going to regain its autonomy and independence and become an outward looking organisation, you know, and buy Super League or, you know, whatever. We don't know. We're in the middle of that book at the moment, you know.
When I spoke to Tony Collins, he, you know, talking about the woes of the English game, he just kind of offhandedly seemed to suggest that these things work in cycles and the English game will likely have it go through a good patch again. Do you subscribe to that, both in terms of England and the NRL? Do you think it is a cyclical thing?
No, because, I mean, the biggest sport in Sydney in 1904, 1905 was rowing. You know what I mean? So the actions of people, the technological advances of the high-speed printing press, then radio and then TV, they changed the course of these cycles. And certainly the introduction of pay television is responsible for all these things we're talking about now. So I don't think English rugby, it's a given that English rugby league is going to bounce back to the point where we had, you know, where Martin Afire, Ellery Hanley and Sean Edwards were national celebrities. I don't see Luke Gale or, you know, any of these people, you know, definitely becoming, you know, people who'll be stopped in the street in London because rugby league hasn't really, the thing that made Balmain a more important thing than we imagined in 1995 is what makes the Premier League such a behemoth now, because I used to write a story about these things that appeared once a day and now people tweet about them every 30 seconds. So it enshrines what's big and it punishes what isn't. So I don't think it's necessarily a cycle. I think the decisions of people like Ralph Rimmer and Simon Johnson and Peter Volandis and Andrew Abdo, Ken Davey, Rodri Jones, the people I'm talking about over here, the decisions of those people can have a lasting impact on it. It isn't just an interminable cycle, I don't think, no.
Well, probably a mistake to ask that question to finish, because I could have predicted your answer, and it's maybe not the most positive note to go out on. But this was an amazing chat, Steve. Thanks so much for this. And anyone who hasn't got it already, please sign up to the Substack. Even if you don't want to do that, make sure you get a copy of Two Tribes. But it's a great achievement, and really appreciate you joining.
I'll say this. I will, because obviously we're all kind of brethren on this niche subject. So I'm trying to, but I obviously don't want to lose money. So what I'll do is, and you put it in the show notes, if you go to stevemascord.com/product/two tribes in Australia, and you put in Rugby League Digest as your checkout code, the book will be $35, not $37.50. But you'll also get a copy of Touchstones completely free. And that also works in the UK. So if you go to, just put shop at the start. So it's shop.stevemascord.com/product/two tribes. And you put in Rugby League Digest as your checkout code. I'll send you both books, not just one. And also you get a discount, and it'll be, in the UK, it's $19.99 down to $18. So I'd say if you're in Australia, go to the Southern Hemisphere, go to the Aussie site, and you get both books for less than the price of one. And same in the Northern Hemisphere, just add shop to the start in the Northern Hemisphere.
All right, fantastic. Everyone get on top of that. And best of luck with everything, Steve. And anytime you want to chat about anything else, please hit us up. This has been a really great conversation. Thank you.
No worries. And maybe after you've got to grand final day or December 1997, and then you personally allow yourself to read the book, maybe we can then revisit, some of the anecdotes in there. The one thing I will say to listeners in Australia before we leave, is that I want to do a bunch of events when I want to come back after the World Cup. On December 18, I want to go to that secret restaurant and I'll make a booking for two and it'll go up and up, hopefully during the course of the year. And on December 19, I'd like to do something in the vicinity of the Sydney Football Stadium where effectively the NRL was formed. But I also, look, this sounds stupid, but I'd like to actually do something in all 22 places that hosted a club in 1997. So I really more want to get the support of your audience if I can, not in a monetary sense or a material sense, but just to get the word out about the book and the fact that at the end of the year, you know, wherever you live in Australia, that I might be, you know, in the pub or in the corner. And if you get a few of your mates along, you know, I'd appreciate it. And I'll let everyone know, you know, when I make those plans.
Brilliant. I'm sure the RLD community will be there in droves. So really looking forward to that. But I'll let you go. But thanks so much, Steve, and best of luck with the book.
No, that was awesome. And congratulations on all your work you've been doing on this subject.
Thanks, mate. All right, we'll speak to you next time.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.